from the Department DECO, you are welcome. I've been briefed that we are going to get this presentation. I presume without deciding that it's not going to be too long. That there was some form of another presentation that was supposed to be an add-on. We'll see when we can get it. But we'll give you time to do this presentation. We're discussing with Klupega here that it looks like we'll be chairing a sort of a women's forum.
I object.
All members are females. The presenters are female, so so but we are honored. Honorable Van Lingen.
Chair, if you look at the lady sitting here, you can see, other than you, who are the really dedicated members of parliament who attend meetings.
Now, I know, I want to say up front that Honorable Van Lingen has apologized that he's going to leave us because he's got other matters to attend. The same as with other members, they've told me that they're attending other matters and they're going to join us. They will be late. So we'll start with the presentation and we're happy. You see, there's one who's breaking the women forum now. Just joined us. Not at all, not at all. This should be a matter of national interest. You see that we also have the media today. So as a matter of national interest, DECO, this is our foreign policy, is with regards to our foreign policy issues. There's too much interest on why we want peace as a country, as South Africa. I'm sure you'll shed some light on that. So I'll give you an opportunity. It's been a long time that I haven't been in, but I am Dumisani Gamete. For the next coming few weeks, I chair this committee. I think members will introduce themselves. We're meeting you for the first time. We'll start on my right, and then we'll just go around. And I come from KwaZulu-Natal, because this is the NCOP.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Honorable members of the NCOP, the department, and officials. My name is Veronica, where my surname is KKC. I'm the provincial whip from the Northwest Province, also the whip of this committee. And compliments to those whom I haven't met before. Thank you.
Always, Kamalam Guzogifarand, Tisuka Embuma Koloni, the Mpokwe Wakwan.
Good morning, and I am Elsa Van Lingen. And I am the Eastern Cape. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Bev Abrahams, and I'm from Gauteng.
Good morning. I am Masepa Kodikhale from Limpopo Province.
Bafuna Nimgoni, Free State.
Yeah, let's go over the table. That's it, starting from now. Just introduce yourself.
I'm Abra Bobby of the SABC.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to the members of the NCOP. My name is Nolufefe Dwabayo. I am Director, National Office for Coordination of Peace Missions, housed in the Branch Africa Multilateral within DIRCO. Thank you.
Good morning, members and colleagues. My name is Shamara Ali. I'm a procedural officer within the NCOP.
Good morning. My name is Zoleka Kola, committee assistant.
Good morning. My name is Zwelibanzi Masilela. I'm the content advisor for the committee.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Rebecca Mtilene. I'm the committee secretary.
Now, without waste of time, over to you, Deco.
Thank you, Chair, once more. We are going to be sharing on the participation in international peace missions by South Africa as guided by our white paper on South African participation in international peace missions in South Africa. And our presentation is going to first talk to the objectives of the white paper that guides us in as far as our participation. And we then talk to the background of the revision of the white paper itself, because the current one that has been endorsed and approved was since approved in 1999, and then we revised it based on our participation experiences in various missions that we have contributed to. Then we will be talking to the guiding principles and procedures for participation. And those guiding principles will be talking to our foreign policy in a way and our interests and why we believe we should be contributing the way we do. Then we then talk to the South African contribution and the coordination and implementation of the requests that are coming from the mandating authorities, those being your UN, the AU, and SADC, and sometimes bilateral requests. On the objective, the white paper is the policy framework that guides South Africa's participation in international peacekeeping. This framework is premised on the country's foreign policy objectives, which are guided by the country's vision of a better South Africa, a better world, and a better Africa. And this, the white paper again, presides or takes its milieu from the following foreign policy principles, that is prioritization of the interests of the African continent as members of the African Union, promotion of human rights and democracy, which is guided by our constitution, adherence to justice and international law, promotion of international peace and multilateralism in the resolution of conflict, the promotion of regional and international integration as a way to foster economic growth and cooperation. The values enshrined in the country's constitution underpin South Africa's national interest and its participation in international peace missions. And these are the securing of the safety of the state and its citizens, promoting the social and economic well-being of its citizens, encouraging global peace and stability, participating in the processes to ensure regional peace, stability, and development. And the mandates or the mandates for South Africa's participation in international peace missions are derived from four levels, and that is the UN, that is the United Nations, the African Union, or the AU, the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, and a national level. And as far as United Nations mandates are concerned, South Africa's approach to peace and security is guided by the objectives and principles of the United Nations Charter. And these principles include the element of consent, which entails commitment by parties to the conflict to a political process and their acceptance of a peacekeeping mandate that supports the process. The element of impartiality, which refers to the implementation of the UN mandate without favor or prejudice to any party to the conflict, and the non-use of force except in self-defense, which suggests that peace missions are mandated to use force only as a measure or as a measure of last resort and only when all other methods of persuasion have been exhausted. The UN, therefore, is the primary organization responsible for the maintenance of international peace and security, is also responsible for mandating peace missions. The responsibility for the conduct of a peace mission lies with the UN Security Council,
while the UN General Assembly maintains the responsibility to provide direction and supervision for peace missions. While the authority to establish a peace mission rests with the UN Security Council, the authority to deploy is derived in part from the consent of the host country. And the principle of consent and request by the host country is essential for the establishment of a peace mission in any sovereign territory. Coming to the African Union mandate, the AU is responsible for the promotion of peace, security and stability in Africa and derives its mandate from the Charter of the UN, Chapter 8, which provides for the regional organizations to participate in peace missions in their respective regions on the basis of their initiative. However, an involvement in peace enforcement operations must receive prior authorization from the UN Security Council. And Article 3 of the African Union Constitutive Act provides for the AU to promote peace, security and stability and encourage international cooperation, taking due account of the UN Charter and the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. Article 4, specifically Articles 4H and 4J of the African Constitution Constitutive Act affirms the right of the African Union to intervene in a member state pursuant to a decision of the Assembly, which is the Assembly of the Heads of State, in respect of grave circumstances like war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. And the protocol relating to the establishment of the Peace and Security Council of the African Union and the AU post-reconstruction and development policy seek to prevent conflict and improve the timeline, effectiveness, and coordination of peace-building and post-conflict reconstruction and development activities in line with Africa's vision for renewal. Similarly, the New Partnership for Africa's Development, which we commonly know as NEPAD, stresses that long-term peace and security in Africa requires policy measures to address the political, economic, and social vulnerabilities on which conflict is premised. Then moving down to the sub-regions, the SADC that we belong to, the protocol on the establishment of the AU Peace and Security Council allows for the participation in peace missions through the Southern African Development Community. Article 16 of the protocol states that the AU Peace and Security, in consultation with regional mechanisms, will endeavor to promote initiatives aimed at anticipating and preventing conflict. Article 2 of the SADC Protocol on Politics, Defense and Security Cooperation stipulates that the overall objectives of the organ on politics, defense and security shall be to promote peace, security and defense cooperation in the region through the prevention, management and resolution of conflicts in order to achieve sustainable peace and security. In executing this mandate, SADC is guided by the principles enshrined in the UN Charter, the AU Constitutive Act, the AU Peace and Security Protocol, and the Common African Defense and Security Policy, sometimes known as the Defense Pact of the African Union. And when it comes to the national mandate, South Africa's foreign policy is informed by its domestic policy, and the two policies are mutually reinforcing. The country's domestic policy is underscored by its values and national interests of a democratic, peaceful, prosperous, non-racist, non-sexist society with respect for human dignity, the achievement of equality, the advancement of human rights and freedom that contribute to a world that is just and equitable. Participation in international peace missions, particularly in Africa, is guided by the country's foreign policy objectives of promoting the peaceful resolution of conflict, the creation of an environment that is conducive for sustainable development, and commitment to rules-based multilateralism. Similarly, participation in peace missions arising from requests of individual countries shall be guided by the same foreign policy objectives and international obligations. The UN, the AU and SADC mandates on peace missions are the cornerstones within which South Africa's participation in peace missions is premised. In terms of the white paper that guides our participation in this peacekeeping mission, the background on the revision is that the revision of the white paper on South Africa's participation in international peace mission is informed by the persistent changes in the international security environment, which require changes in the approaches to bring about peace and security. There has also been a shift from the traditional approach of United Nations peace mission to a multidimensional approach to peace mission. That is now, instead of focusing more on the uniformed personnel or the military, there is also a civilian dimension. And again, the police element is a new phenomenon in peacekeeping missions. And the term multidimensional is in talks to those three pillars, with the two that have been introduced later. The traditional approach to peace missions were limited to the participation of the military, as I've said, in peace missions and the interposition of a peacekeeping force between the warring factions. That is, the creation and maintenance of buffer zones, monitoring and observing ceasefire, stabilizing situations so that efforts could be made at the political level to resolve the conflict by peaceful means. The multidimensional approach came about as a result of the complex nature of conflict and to address the limitations of the traditional approach to peace mission, in particular, the role of the military in post-conflict situations. Multidimensional peace missions, as I said, comprise the civilian, military, and police components, which are intended to be mutually reinforcing so as to effectively address the root causes of conflict that have historical, political, social, and economic human rights dimensions. In the recent years, an increase in the incidences of intrastate conflicts and in the complexities of these conflicts have been witnessed. Thus, there was a need for the United Nations to strengthen its partnerships with regional arrangements in dealing with matters relating to the maintenance of peace and security. The role of these regional arrangements is articulated in Chapter 8 of the UN Charter, provided that such arrangements or agencies and their activities are consistent with the purposes and principles of the United Nations. The African Union, together with other regional organizations, continues to play a critical role in supporting the global UN peace and security mandate. The establishment of the African Union Peace and Security Council in 2002 renewed commitment to create an effective mechanism for the prevention, management, and resolution of African conflict. Regional mechanisms such as FADEC or the Southern African Development Community are part of the continent's overall security architecture. The primary responsibility of these mechanisms is to promote peace, security, stability, and sustainable development in Africa. South Africa is committed to the mainstreaming of gender in peace missions and in the promotion of gender equality. South Africa believes in the principle of equal rights, full and effective representation and participation of women and men in decision-making processes and programs for conflict prevention, peacemaking, peacekeeping, post-conflict reconstruction and development. This commitment needed to be reflected in the white paper, that is the white paper on South Africa's participation in peacekeeping missions. And the guiding principles and procedures for participation that seek to affirm or infuse the engendering of peacekeeping are the following. South Africa's participation in peace missions is informed by the clear mandate. That is, the mandate for a peace mission must be clear and achievable. It must also be agreed to amongst the others, the UN, continental and regional bodies, the host country, parties to the conflict, and contributing countries. Then the element of consent, which entails commitment by parties to the conflict to a political process and their acceptance of a peace mission mandate that supports the processes. The element of impartiality, which refers to implementation of the mandate without favor or prejudice to any party to the conflict. Then the minimum use of force, which refers to the use of force as a measure of last resort when other methods of persuasion have been exhausted. Then the element of credibility. This is a direct reflection of the international and local community's belief in the mission's ability to achieve its mandate. then the element of legitimacy. This is premised on the basis of the UN, the AU, SADC mandate for purposes of an understanding amongst the parties to the conflict and the population that the peace mission is not only justified, but also seen to be the representative of the determination and aspirations of the international community. And the promotion of national and local ownership, every effort should be made to promote national and local, which is host country, ownership, to foster trust and cooperation between national and international actors. Then entry, transit, and exit strategy. Entrance into the mission area of any multinational peace mission should be preceded by an assessment of the situation and objectives of the mission within which the peace mission will be deployed. There should be clear transition and exit strategy before committing a national contingent to any peace mission. Then we also have an adequate means. The commitment of adequate resources to peace missions shall be informed by a clear and achievable mandate to attain the stated goals and objectives. And this talks to the element that nations are always complaining about, financial constraints and the equipment that is necessary to execute a peacekeeping mission. Then we talk also to the element of transparency. Shared communication is key in the success of a peace operation. The parties to the conflict as well as the local population must be fully aware of the mandate of the peace mission, its functions and responsibilities, and how the different components will be conducting their duties. And lastly, unity of effort and multilateral and regional cooperation, that is the various components of the peace mission must cooperate towards the achievement of the mandate. When it comes to South African contribution, South Africa is obliged by the White Paper on South Africa's participation in international peace missions to contribute to the following components of the UN standby arrangement system, the AU standby force, and the SADC brigade. The civilian component, which I have referred to above, refers to all government officials who are employed under the Public Service Act of 1994 and Correctional Service Act 111 of 1998, with the exception of the official employed under the Defense Act number 42 of 2002 and the South African Police Service Act number 68 of 1995. This also includes civilians outside government who volunteer to participate in peace missions as part of the government contingent. Referring to the military component, we say we refer to defense forces whose role, amongst others, is to support the political intent in establishing conditions for safety, security, and stability in the most appropriate manner. And the police component refers to individual police, formed police units, whose main role includes monitoring and providing assistance with law enforcement functions carried out by the national or local police forces in order to ensure that law and order were maintained effectively and impartially and that human rights and fundamental freedoms were protected. The level, size, and deployment of the South African contribution will depend on the mandate of the peace mission and the extent to which the mission fits with the South African's foreign policy objective. And talking to the current contributions that South Africa is making to these peace missions. As of December 2013, South Africa has a total number of 2,092 experts, military and police personnel deployed in Intervention Brigade of the United Nations Organization Stabilization Mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is shortly known as MONUSCO. The African Union United Nations Hybrid Operation in Darfur, Sudan, which is known as UNAMID, and the United Nations Mission in the South Sudan under the New Republic of Southern Sudan, UNMID. The breakdown in accordance with the missions is as follows. The Intervention Brigade of MONUSCO comprises four experts and 1,303 military troops. And the UNAMID one, South Africa has deployed 15 experts, 44 police, and 804 troops. The UNMISS has 17 members of the South African Police Service deployed under it, and South Africa will be deploying additional police to the mission should the request be approved from the United Nations. In terms of coordination and implementation, the white paper maintains that the National Office for the Coordination of Peace Mission within the Department of International Relations and Cooperation is responsible for the coordination of South Africa's participation in peace mission. The role of the NOCPM is to ensure and to facilitate the coordinated execution of the SA government policy on the enhancement of South Africa's capacity for peace missions and participation in international peace missions. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks very much for that presentation. Now you will engage, as I said earlier on, that the briefing was to deal with white paper on South African policy. That was the first one which we won't have. And then this one that we have given, which deals with the revised white paper on the South African participation in international peacekeeping missions. So, honorable members, who have heard this briefing, South Africa needs to contribute, and the laws in our country need to be in line with what we do internationally. I want to give first members an opportunity. There are two members who didn't introduce themselves, so that when the time comes, they ask. The two members that haven't introduced themselves, they can introduce themselves now.
Good morning, Chairperson. I'm Kenneth Sinclair. I represent the Northern Cape Province.
There's the other one. Oh, who hasn't introduced himself? He did. What? Last year. Not this year.
Chairperson, I think I introduced myself when I come in. I was the first man to introduce myself among the MPs, Chairperson.
I thought I introduced you. Okay, thanks. Now, let's engage on this. For me, because I haven't been around for some time, one thing that I noticed that seems to be missing on this thing. You know, if there are conflicts, whether we call them rebels or terrorists or what, I don't see the mention of people that fund these people. You know, whether you talk of Libya or Cuba or Egypt, there are no rebels that can just stand up on their own and fight a democratically elected government. There are some funders somewhere. I think we need to talk. I think the department needs to tell us what will be the role of the country in international relations, because that will affect the relationship of South Africa and another country. Let's take the DRC. If there is a country that is supporting rebels and so on, it affects the relationship between South Africa and that country. I think we must be having some of those things in the white paper. But how do we do it? The minister once said, now there's a new tendency in Africa. You stage a coup as a leader, and then you organize elections, and you say then they are democratic. That's the second issue. How do you stop these coups? Because in most cases, these are coups done to democratically elected government. And then they say, I'll spend 18 months and then have democratic. Then you are arranging elections, you are actually in charge, then you end up being elected. So that's the second part that is, I think we need to deal with on. The last one would be, I remember there was this, I don't know how far it is, the African thing on democracy, peace, elections, and governance, where member countries didn't sign. I know South Africa signed. So it's difficult to enforce any punitive measure. If countries in Africa say we want peace, want democracy, and want freedom, yet at the same time they don't sign that that declaration, and then you cannot punish them when there's a coup. So those are the things that one would need for clarification on how do we really deal with those. Honorable Ranto.
Chair, as you have already said that I'm a new member in this committee, I might be out of order in other questions that I will ask, but I think I need to exercise my democratic right as a new member of this of this committee. I'm aware there is this international peace mission that we should be part of it. But what I would like the department maybe this question of mine will affect other things, or maybe it will not be the department may not be completely in a position to answer it. But I want us to check how do we describe a democratically elected government, because I'm asking this question in other countries, especially in the African countries. We in South Africa, when we talk about a democratically elected person, everybody gets involved and elects that government to be in power. And then in other countries, this democratically elected, as they called it, government, has been elected by a group of other people, and the others were not involved in those elections or in the processes of elections, and yet that country, that are dealing with elections, they will say those elections were free and fair because there was no war, there was no conflict, there was nothing. Maybe the other people just decided to withdraw and not take part in the elections, and yet those elections are still declared as democratic elections, and the government that is in power is a democratic government. And yet there are still people who are suffering under that democratic government.
It will be Honorable Sinclair, then Honorable Baird, then Honorable Ngun in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, it seems to me that the heart of this debate about the revision of the white paper lies the issue of the establishment of democratic principles in many countries. Now, democracy can have many manifestations, as you rightly say. People in some countries, you know, have different interpretations about what is democracy. And democracy in many of the developing countries in Africa has got serious undertones that's linked to economic benefits and economic development. Now, if you take the dynamics of the countries where South Africa is now involved in the peace missions and so on, much of those internal conflicts that derive from democracy are linked to mineral wealth and oil. The issue that comes to the fore is in terms of the department's approach and the South African government approach regarding economic diplomacy. How do these two, the peace mission and our economic diplomacy, how do they integrate, how do they link? We know what happened in the DRC, Bangui, which was not a very good example of a peacekeeping mission with the US, CRC, sorry, not in DRC, in the Central Republic, which wasn't a very good example. And I think that was a clarion call for South Africa also to look at the approach to this. Now, the issue that I raised then is the issue about economic diplomacy and this people that parade sometimes many elements of democracy, but in essence, are, with due respect, aren't real democrats. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I have two questions. The one is, I've noted that the revised white paper is dated the 7th of November and the draft white paper the 5th of December 2012, respectively. My question is why the hariskari, why the, and why the delay since 2012? What happened in 2013? Why didn't we have a look at it? And then I'd like to ask a question, the, does this mandate of the AU include voting against the prosecution of African leaders for war crimes? Recently in the news it was shown that only Botswana voted against the stating that leaders must be prosecuted for war crimes. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just two questions. The first one is when participating in peace missions, so you just mentioned CAR, what do we do where we are being attacked? South Africa is in a peace mission, like in the UNESCO, and we are being attacked. In the foreign paper, saying you must use minimum force. The second question is post-conflict reconstruction. Do we see ourselves playing a role through SAFTA, or are we going to wait for OGA from Europe, official announcement from Europe or from other countries? Thanks.
Just to respond to those comments and questions.
Thank you, Chair. On the first question, which was your question, you mentioned the issue of the rebels and the countries that are alleged or that are allegedly funding the rebel groups in conflict situations and what it is that is being done about those within the context of the African Union, and how do we then deal with these countries as a country for Africa? One, there is a declaration of 2000 on unconstitutional changes of government that the AU is using as its anchor and the legal framework to deal with the cases of unconstitutional change. And following the Arab Spring, we have, as the African Union, been trying to revisit and revise this declaration because it does not talk to the current situation of the milieu that these conflicts are beginning to take. And as such, that declaration is the instrument that talks to these elements. And in the previous year's summit, in January and mid-year, which is June, July, the heads of state have put it to the organs of the African Union that this declaration needs to be revised, and it must talk to this idea that we don't seem as the African collective to talk to mutiny as mutiny. And then it translates to rebel groups that are fighting for whatever is amiss in the governance process. And these mutineers, rebel groups then begin to qualify as political partners. That then begin to be graceful governments that came through the ladders that are not compatible with the claims of the Constitutive Act and this declaration of unconstitutional change of government. So there is a debate and a discussion that this needs to be revisited to spell out that we cannot afford a situation where we have mutineering parties that tend to rival groups, tend to political parties, and become to be governed. And CAR again, which is the Central African Republic, is the example that is being quoted constantly. And there is that debate going on. But the constitutive, I mean, the 2000 Declaration on Unconstitutional Changes of Government, as it stands, is the instrument that talks to all of this. As South Africa, how do we deal with this? The very idea of revisiting the declaration was mooted by South Africa. So that debate has been initiated by South Africa, and it's going on, and it has been put in the decisions and the discussions of the African Union. And hopefully, as we are going to be assuming participation in April within the AU Peace and Security, we shall continue to fight for this to be part of the African. Then, the Charter on Good Governance, Democracy and Elections. Again, if the members would look closely at post-conflict reconstruction and development framework of the African Union and our participation in these various missions, especially the DRC and the Darfur, we are talking about PCRD that anchors its activities on reconstruction, that talks to the rule of law, governance, and all the necessary principles that need to be there. And as such, for those countries or entities that have not ratified this charter, there is a window that allows that transformation to happen, which is post-conflict reconstruction and development, because it stipulates what needs to be done in terms of rule of law, election, security sector reform, and resuscitation of the government institution. So that is the way that we are employing for those entities that have not assigned. Then question two by Honorable Ranto. How do we describe a democratically elected government? This one is a very interesting one if we use ourselves as a yardstick. We might perhaps have to nullify every election that we participate in. But what saves the world or saves the day is the element of sovereignty that is embedded within the Constitutive Act of the African Union, within the Charter of the African Union, within the protocols of the African Union, which says when there is a conflict, the first or the common clause in any agreement that is AU-based, UN-based, you are talking about constitutional order. And that constitutional order is the anchor on which all other processes follow. And therefore, if we have a variety of constitutions, then we'll have a variety of processes and endorsements that will not necessarily emulate what South Africa talks to. But the common objective and the common basis is in the Constitutive Act, is on the agreements that are being signed, and it is on the Charter of the African Union on good governance, democracy, and elections. And what constitutes a democratically elected government is according to the constitution of that particular nation and the rules and regulations of the election processes that have been endorsed and agreed upon by those particular parties. That is why we are also talking of a policy of non-imposition. Therefore, what is my democracy might not be. Yes. So we have to face those dynamics within the rhythm of what we are doing, and invited to observe by the African Union, by the SADC region, or the UN where it happens. So we are faced with those dilemmas. And whoever gets to deploy a group of election observers is governed by the specification of that particular mandate. And at no stage you are able to operate as an individual if you are not bilaterally invited with stipulated terms of reference as to what it is that you need to do. So that's what makes a difference and makes it a constant challenging exercise. Then, Honorable Sinclair, economic diplomacy and peace mission, example being Syria. And what it is that we're doing and focusing on when we're looking at those, or do we even look at those? I understand you correctly. Thank you. You know, if we go to our foreign policy, which talks to a just, free South Africa, the continent and the world, we do not have a proviso that says we will contribute to these activities only if there's an economic gain. And as such, we begin to be the entities of preference in terms of neutrality, high moral ground, and principle. Does that really help us in the current realm or in the current way of doing things? That's South Africa we have to discuss and debate and come up with it. And again, if we follow the example of Bangui that you mentioned, we will realize, as I believe we know, that we are talking about a fairly divided Africa that is divided on the basis of its former colonizers as individual protectorates that begin to even form the African Union region along those lines. Like, for instance, if you're talking about CAR, it belongs to ECOWAS. It belongs to Francophone states. It takes the milieu of Francophone statutes. And it has a 50-year agreement that in its own soil, it will only dig 10 meters down below that it's found. And those agreements have a serious impact on what Africa is trying to do and what the current leadership within those individual countries aspire to. And perhaps the African Union needs to talk seriously about these agreements, because a lot of them have since expired, some are about to expire, and perhaps the main reason why we see a rejuvenation of French activity within the continent is the fact that those agreements are expiring, and the backbone of the French economy is in Africa, is in those countries, and they are ready to defend their economy with all what it takes. And that, unfortunately, what is written down within the legal framework is what holds. All the discussions sometimes become very cheap to be able to hold the core and the center. So we are really faced with a number of challenges that date as far back as 50 years, especially when it comes to CAR. Now, the element of defense that talks to what do we do when we get to be attacked. That, again, it is enshrined within the Constitutive Act of the African Union, its Protocol on Peace and Security, and the UN Charter itself, emulated by SADC. The use of force for self-defense. You match the situation on the ground when you are faced with a threat. You have to defend yourself. The charter says that. You can't be attacked and you can retreat depending on the skill of the fighter jets and whoever that is there. But on the legal framework of the African Union, of the UN, and of SADC, you have to retaliate in terms of self-defense. You can defend yourself in terms of self-defense, and you can match the standard in terms of self-defense. That's what guides our response to what happened. Then I've thrown in your question into what I was responding to, but I'll come back again to PCRD if you allow me to. Then the delay on the review that you see on those papers. It is not a delay on the paper, it is a delay on the alignment that needs to be done from the political DIRCO side and the military defense review side, which has to be in sync with all these policies, because they are carrying a political mandate that talks to their capabilities, their appreciations and their policies as an entity that carries the political money within this community. So as we are sitting here, there will be a meeting on Monday within the structures of DOD to look at their defense review processes and try to align with the revised white paper. As soon as they are done doing that, this shall be presented with amendments or without amendments. But so far it doesn't look like there are amendments. I spoke to them last night, but they're just finalizing their internal processes to be able to do this. And then again, Is the AU statute talks against the execution the ma'am, can you repeat this question of you?
Does the mandate of the AU include voting against the prosecution of everything in this war crime?
The AU is a progressive entity. The execution of heads of state or those that have cases against war crime, it is the debate that is three-pronged. We have the ICCJ. We have the African courts, we have the UN, that is a kind of a supreme body that carries the credibility to intervene and decipher when there is a need. And there is an Article 16 of the ICJ statute that says when there is a situation that means that there should be deferral, we can then refer to the UN that can stand on anybody's behalf who is facing that particular situation and intervene and intercede with the ICCJ. And the feeling of the African community is that the laws of the ICC, they are looking like a witch hunt for Africa. Because a lot of these prosecutions are happening within the African context and the African reality. And understandably so, because if you read and look at the statistics of where conflict is common, it is within the African state. And as such, the practice, unfortunately, of how far feasible it is to execute the statutes and the laws of the ICC look like attested in Africa. And that is a concern. But it is not the policy of the African Union to say, do not look at these crimes and its perpetrators. We support that, but the processes that are being employed, they should be transparent, and we should understand exactly what it is that is being done. And unfortunately, there's a feeling that the processes are not really transparent, and we're calling for that particular transparency. Thank you. Then the element of self-defense, I've spoken to that, Honorable Mbuni. And what do we do? Are we participating towards PCRD, that is post-conflict reconstruction and development? Yes, we do. And again, we don't really depend on foreign assistance when it comes to that. Because we have since realized that the agendas and programs that are funded somewhere else are not really the agendas that we have sent for and that we want to achieve and to drive as the African community. And upon discussing this issue, because it was really a key issue, Africa as a collective decided to have what we call the African Solidarity Initiative, which talks to post-conflict reconstruction and development, which says we do not have to have financing as African entities to assist in situations of post-conflict reconstruction and development. We can use human resources, our services, exchange programs, and whatever we can, like we are doing in Southern Sudan, like we are doing in the DRC, like we did in CAR, despite the unpalatable finish in CAR. But it was a kind of an exchange of what we have, sharing of what we have, giving what we can in terms of services and human resources, not necessarily financing. So the training and some capacity that is being given, depending on the areas of need that are identified by the host countries or the countries emerging from conflict, are then looked under this African Solidarity Initiative. But I will not romanticize this initiative and say that it is self-sustainable, because we have a lot of challenges, and some entities still want to understand, if you're saying you're offering this kind of assistance to me, what is it that you want? And that takes a bit longer. And again, on the backdrop of what I've mentioned, we have countries that are still dependent on France and other entities, and I'm mentioning France here because we're using CAR as an example, which is very skeptical about security sector reform, because in every colony that they had, or in every country that they were, the security sector is so informal. They are talking key point when they are talking police service, the gendarme. And they are neither police service in according to our constitution and our laws, or the military. They are something in between. And they are loose formations that you can't really command and have an obligation, give them an obligation to serve as a unified entity based on the constitution that is there. And the checks and balances that we have in terms of our security sector, they can be exercised. And that is why it was becoming too much of a poke in their skin to have a security sector training in Syria. It gave them goosebumps, because it was saying in a nutshell that we are trying to assist their colony to reorganize itself to be a formidable state that has a strong force, that can react and respond equally. So that is where we are in post-conflict reconciliation and development. And we are in Sudan, we are in the DRC, and we do a lot with Sierra Leone, and we also helping with Madagascar. And in a way, we're trying to assist our neighbors in the northern. Yes. I don't know if I've left out anything, but I think I've touched on all of those.
Thanks for those responses. You know, this is still a white paper. It's still white. Things gonna change. There are a lot of issues that will continue and we still want to raise.
Yes.
But then, as we move on and we engage, we'll get under the issue of proportional contribution. We look at countries in Africa and our part of South Africa, how proportionally, you know, do we contribute? Those are the issues that we still want to. And also the issue of, you know, there's a saying in English that he who pays the piper plays the chosen. Now, these countries that we are afraid to mention, whether in the West or in Europe or whatever, and they pay, they definitely, you know, say, now dance and do this and that. These are the real issues that we need to tackle. As a country and also as Africa. I personally feel Africa needs to be strong on itself first before it can try to, you know, advance to the other countries. That is why I think the African Charter was a very good yardstick. If all countries had signed, that would have shown commitment that as Africa, this is now what we have decided. Also, on your homework, the issue of responsiveness in the white paper, it doesn't show how soon should we, you know, respond to anything. There must be an idea. It's always thought of as if we always go to a country when it's in ruin. But you can see that things are happening. When everything, all the buildings have been built over, then we go there and say, now, we want peace and want to establish. So I think there must be some sort of time frame put that if something starts in a country, we need to move very quickly. Now, for the sake of peace, for the sake of women, for the sake of children, those people are never considered in a war situation until the war is over. So that should be, I think, the guiding principle that if children and women, and of course, people with disabilities are at much higher risk. We need to move very fast in any other country. So I'm not sure even people that are going to continue in the next term will move very quickly with this program, with this, when it becomes a bill, so that we have something that is properly crafted and so on. And lastly, South Africa, to a certain extent in other African countries, also regarded as it has a big brother approach. The people who think it has got its foot here, and we need to smoothen those relations and say, how do we work as a collective, as Africa? What was said by Honorable Sinclair is actually correct. The root cause of all these civil wars in Africa is economic. Nothing to do about political and so it's economic. So I think we need to be upfront and say, that's why I say Africa itself must rise and say Africa, for whether we say for Africans, before we think of France and all these other countries. But I'm not sure. I wanted, because this is a white paper, us to have this briefing. There's still going to be a lot of more of this discussion. We're still going to need a lot of research. And most of the people that are coming back here, they'll continue with this thing in the next term. But if I could have before you have the closing remarks, I'll have one member introducing himself so that we talk most of the things offline.
Honorable Member Ranto. Good morning, Chairperson. Yeah, sorry that I'm late, but I've did send the message through to the Secretary. Chairperson, my name is Freddie Adams, permanent delegate from the Western Cape. I think this protocol, or what is this, the white paper, also has got an impact on the Western Cape as they are also not part of South Africa.
I was given a book by one of your colleagues, Parting Shots, but your parting words.
Thank you, Chair. Before I say my say as the parting entity, let me first thank the committee through you, Chair, for your constant interest and your input on these things, because it is only through these interactions and sharing sessions that we can improve and revise on all what we are doing and try to stand upright and lift our chins high out there representing your views and having heard the sense of what is happening in the representation of South Africa. And in terms of what we have discussed and debated, I am in agreement fully with the rapid response capacity of our mandating entities, if I can call them that, which is your UN, your AU, and your SADC. Depending on the EU. And perhaps it is important that I mention this in this gathering, that again last year South Africa introduced an entity or an organ or an interim measure that talks to your concerns, Chair, in terms of rapid response to these conflicts. Because what is happening in the multilateral setting, unfortunately, is that the debates are dragged by individual interests that seem to be at loggerheads and perhaps seem to be moving parallel for various reasons. And you might recall that Africa introduced what we call the African standby force, because there was a feeling that the UN does not respond in time or at least prioritize situations that are urgent in Africa. And Rwanda was always mentioned as an example. And we then came up with the idea that perhaps we need our own African standby force that would try to respond to these issues as soon as possible. And again, it is proven to be a challenge to meet the time frames that we set ourselves as Africa, to have an African standby force rapid response capacity by 2015. And having realized that we proposed an African immediate response to crisis situations in Africa, that we are trying to operationalize as soon as possible because of your concern. And within our white paper, we have time frames for response. But as we might also recall, we are mandated and working under the umbrella of the collective. And only when we get to be invited can we respond within those 90, 30 days, depending on the situation on the ground. But in terms of the concerns that are being raised, the white paper in its own chapters have these measures there. But the issue is that if the AU decides to respond on any case after 50, 30 days, we are caught up in that thing, until perhaps we move bilaterally, which is not advisable in many instances, in many situations. And again, we will continue with the debate on the rebel groups and the countries that are aligning themselves with rebel entities within conflict situations. And hopefully, when the declaration on unconstitutional changes of government takes shape, there shall be a briefing of this nature that will put the membership at ease and understand that the concerns that are projected here are being taken care of. And I thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Members, next week we'll be doing the final mandate on the negotiating mandate on the legal metrology bill. You'll get all the details, but this is one bill that we want to finalize before the end of this term. Now that brings us to the end of this meeting, and the meeting is adjourned. Thanks very much.
It's all very complicated. Don't understand.